Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hey fans, Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, your host of the podcast, sports dietitian, entrepreneur, runner, and owner of Rise Up Nutrition. We have a guest episode today, and I feel like she doesn't need an introduction because in my world, she's extremely well known, my world that is of female athlete fueling and training, but she deserves to get the recognition for all of her accomplishments. So I will read off her bio. And for those of you who don't know, today I am talking with Dr. Stacy Sims. Dr. Sims is a forward-thinking international exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist who aims to revolutionize exercise nutrition and performance for women. She has directed research programs at Stanford, AUT University, and the University of Waikato, focusing on female athlete health and performance and pushing the dogma to improve research on all women. With the unique opportunities Silicon Valley has to offer, during her tenure at Stanford, she had the opportunity to translate earlier research into consumer products and a science-based layperson's book named ROAR, written to explain sex differences in training and nutrition across the lifespan. Both the consumer products and the book challenge the existing dogma for women in exercise, nutrition, and health. The paradigm shift that is the focus of her famous TEDx talk, Women Are Not Small Men. Stacy's contributions to the international research environment and the sports nutrition industry has established a new niche in sports nutrition and established her reputation as the expert in sex differences in training, nutrition, and health. As a direct result, she has been named one of the top 50 visionaries of the running industry by DMSE Sports in 2015. Dr. Sims is named one of the top 40 women changing the paradigm of her field by Outside Magazine in 2017, one of the top 4 visionaries in the outdoor sports industry by Outside Magazine, The Genius Issue in 2017, and one of the top 4 individuals changing the landscape in triathlon nutrition by Triathlete Magazine in 2017. Dr. Sims has published over 70 peer-reviewed papers, several books, and is regularly featured speaker at professional and academic conferences, including those by USOC, U.S. Olympic Committee, and USA Cycling. Stacy currently holds a senior research associate position with SPRINS AUT University, supervises PhD students, writes academic papers, and is on the advisory board of some cutting-edge companies, including Tonal Strength Institute, Wild AI, and Exos. She also has her own business, found at www.drstacysims.com, where she creates and delivers online learning material focused on women training their physiology across the lifespan. Dr. Sims currently resides at the beach in New Zealand with her husband and young daughter. I'm so excited for this episode and also want to be upfront in letting you know that myself as a sports dietitian specializing in female athlete fueling, I keep up with Dr. Sims and her research. I have read her books. I have taken her courses. I have my own training. And then frankly, I am trained in a sense under her wing of always following her research and what she's putting out as well. So she's absolutely a leader in female athlete nutrition and super excited for you to listen to this episode. Enjoy. Dr. Sims, I'm so excited. You've been on my list of guests to have for a while now. And as I mentioned already to you, I've been a huge fan and follower of yours, so I feel like I'm speaking to a friend already. But this is the first time you're on our podcast. Thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
It's fun.
Yeah. You know, and I just think your personal story, which you've shared a ton before and you have a TED talk about as well, of how you got into your passion for studying the physiology and nutrition and exercise in women, you know, it's just so interesting how it's like your brain just was like, wait, why aren't we studying this? You know, and you were on crew in university. Was that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were noticing those differences between performance of men and women and not getting the answers you were looking for. And as a student, you had that mindset of, then let's investigate this.
Yeah. That, I guess that's the thing when you're a young, new university student, you're always like, but why? Why? I see it in my own university students. They're always questioning. I was like, oh, wait, I was one of those people. So I better, like answer these as best as I can or try to figure it out because a different point of view, right? So. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think is interesting because now I'm like, oh, I wasn't a very good student then because when I was in school and grad school learning about nutrition and sports nutrition, studying that, I really never questioned it. In fact, I was like bought into the, you know, like comparing numbers and data and I was trying and I was training like a man and I was treating myself like a man. Like I don't know why that part of my brain just shut off and didn't even think about it.
Yeah, I think I had the unique opportunity to have a difference in opinions and views because of the way I grew up. So as an Army brat, traveling to different cultures and then landing in San Francisco to go to high school, and I went to high school near Haight-Ashbury. So it was very much the mindset of there are differences and you see like women are doing certain things, men are doing certain things. And so it was always like, well, why can't women do as much or do better than men? And that, so that thought process had always been there. So when I got to university and I was getting shown all this data from men, I was like, but where's the representation of women? So I think it was, it's not that your brain was working that way. It's just the way that I had experiences growing up and the way my mindset was already pigeonholed in when I got there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I grew up in that culture of where like I can do what a boy is doing or I can do what a man is doing, which in some ways is empowering, but then also meant that I truly treated myself or saw myself as that equal instead of respecting the differences or being curious about the differences. Of course, we can do everything, you know, a man or a boy can do, but there might be differences in the process or in how it happens.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of our culture too. It's like, you don't want to, I guess the whole idea in Western culture is that you don't want to differentiate boys and girls. You want to keep empowering the girls to be like, you can do exactly what they're doing, you know? And so it never really was, you can do exactly what you're doing, but let's do it in a different way to make you better.
Exactly. Oh, that is just, that's the perfect way to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So with that being said, you have been, I think, you know, just an amazing person of our generation to finally say, okay, like the science of exercise and physiology and nutrition and health in general for girls and women is different. And we really started to get that research going. Where, you know, 15 years ago, there just wasn't research on women because they said that, you know, researchers said controlling for menstrual cycles was just too difficult. So we're just not going to do it.
Right.
Do you have any, like, I don't know if this is too specific of a question, but like, what percentage of research out there is done specifically on women or to be even more specific, female athletes? Because it's still not very much.
It isn't very much. I mean, if we look at the sports science research, I think they say 4-6% is done on women. And in that 4-6%, not all the methods are good enough to be specific to women. They're usually designed in a male lens and then they use post hoc stats to go back and look at differences. And a lot of these studies are underpowered. So even though we have women in these studies, it's still not robust enough to dig down into a lot of the differences and effects that we really want to know.
Yeah, and I think that's important because as much information as we are learning, we still just don't have, and there's still a lot of unknowns that we still have to figure out.
Yeah, and in that too, I mean, because we are in that area where there isn't a lot of robust, quote, science. What people also forget is the case studies, the case reports,
to individual anecdotal studies that are case studies, I guess, that come out. None of those are ever included in like the systematic reviews, the meta-analyses, when they start looking at effects for women. And that's a fault, because when we're looking specifically at elite athletes in particular, it's really hard to get a large N of elite athletes. Mm-hmm. So you'll see case studies, you'll see an N of 5, and that's like a pilot study, right? So that can give you some information and give you insight into which direction to go. But those studies are often ignored. And so right now we're having this conversation of there's no evidence in sports science to say menstrual cycle strength-based training, or there's no evidence to say blah, 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 blah. But when you look at the studies, it's like 5 studies or 5 reviews of reviews. And the N is maybe 10 to 12. And then they're using post hoc stats to go back in and look at differences when the study design wasn't actually created to look at those. But they're ignoring the psychological, they're ignoring the endocrinology, they're ignoring the case reports, the case studies. So we have to be very careful when we start saying there's not a lot of evidence or there's no evidence, because it's very specific to sports science research, which we know is very bro science anyway.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, to say only 4-6% of sports science studies are done on women, and then the percentage of that that's good quality and so forth is just going to become smaller and smaller. And then if we're going to get, you know, my specialty nutrition, that's an even smaller window.
Exactly.
There, right? Sports science is more than just nutrition. But I would agree too, and I think as a scientist, you typically don't make these statements based on case studies, right? You do need better quality studies. And yet right now, I can even just say in my experience as a female athlete dietitian, I'm like, yeah, there's things that I don't see in the research, but I know because I've worked with 200 women who have these situations, you know? And it's like, I don't have the article or the study, I can prove it, but I just know in my heart that if you do this, you'll feel better and feel better and perform better. And it is kind of tricky to convince some people of that sometimes when the science isn't there. But I'm like, well, I've worked with hundreds of people who have done this, and it is tough.
Yeah. Well, the science is there. It's just not published because, you know, like the science is there. Your methodology, your experience of 200 people, that is a true method, right? And so it's not a randomized controlled trial, but it's still evidence for you to make practice decisions. And I think that's the misstep, because people, I mean, you have medical community too, and they're like, here's the best practice. But physicians will look at it and be like, well, for this particular person, this isn't the best practice. But as that particular patient, they're not going to question the doctor. But for those of us who are not like medical doctors, we get questioned, where's the science? Where's the science? So it is that nuance. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, yeah, well, here is the 200 to 500 people that I work with, and we know all of these things work. But I don't have the time to sit down and create this into like a paper with stats, because I'm still working with 200 to 500 people.
Right, exactly. Because I can't do everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, so I think, you know, it's important to look at those case studies as well, whereas traditional scientists might not. I think in this situation it is. So maybe for our listeners then, just to hear it from the source, one of the major things that we can say is different about male physiology, female physiology, and therefore how it affects our performance as athletes is differences in our hormones. Mm-hmm. I think for the sake of time, I might kind of pass on that question and refer our listeners to the thousands of other podcasts you've had about that. But the question I want to ask you is it more than just our hormones, or how does those differences in our hormones and females having a menstrual cycle like affect the rest of our body? What are some other differences between male and female physiology?
Well, there are sex differences from birth that actually, well, I should say from in utero, right? So if we go and look at the specific sex differences that are not hormone driven, we see that the muscle mitochondria is different in women versus men. So what I mean by that is our powerhouses. Women's mitochondria have more of the proteins that enable them to use free fatty acids. And so this is why when we look at fasted training or other kinds of, quote, metabolic efficiency, it doesn't really work for women, because the epigenetic exposure isn't going to increase the mitochondria expression for fatty acid use because it's already there. But for men, it does work because it does create a stress that invokes the mitochondrial change to increase fatty acid utilization. We look at things like hemoglobin, red cell carrying capacity. Women have less overall because testosterone drives that, but also blood volume, right? Men have more blood volume. They also have more lean mass as compared to women. We look at bone structure changes and biomechanics. Men have more narrow hips. They have narrower shoulder girdle. So for women, girls from puberty onwards, we have to look at things like, how are we running? What are our running mechanics? How are we landing? Mm-hmm. And makes us more, I guess, predisposed to knee injuries because we're more quad dominant and we don't necessarily use our posterior chain. We look from a metabolic perspective as well. Women go through blood sugar and don't tap so much into their muscle glycogen or liver glycogen. They go blood sugar, a little glycogen into fatty acid utilization. Men, blood sugar, liver, muscle glycogen, a lot of it, deplete it, and then into fatty acid utilization. So when we're looking at like fueling, basic fueling, we see the 30 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour recommendations. Well, we know that that 90 is based on 13 elite male triathletes. And when we look at gastric emptying rate, we look at brush border effect. For women, we have a slower gastric emptying rate. We have a higher response to carbohydrate that sits in the small intestines, and it doesn't diffuse out very quickly as compared to men. We have a higher incidence of gastrointestinal distress because the mucosal lining of our intestines erodes a lot faster than men, primarily because we have less creatine stores. So when we start looking at metabolic aspects for fueling for exercise, we have to really question what we're putting in our bodies so that we can work with our physiology and not listen to all of these things about 90 to 120 grams of mixed sugar carbohydrate. You can train your gut because it doesn't work for women because we have that slower motility through the gut and through the intestines or through the stomach and the intestines, plus that mucosal eroding.
Yeah. And just to continue that aspect, I mean, that I feel like women have so many more GI issues than men. And there's probably a multitude of factors for this, but you just shed light on a few of them for sure.
Yeah.
Especially as it pertains to athletics and like the during run fuel. I mean, women just really struggle a lot more with that.
Yes, they do. And it is, like I said, one of the main trigger factors besides like estrogen creating more leaky gut is that lack of creatine. Because, you know, we look and women have 70 to 80% of the stores, even if they are not vegetarians. And the first thing that goes when you start exercising is that mucosal lining. It gets eroded. But if you have more creatine on board, it preserves it. So that reduces leaky gut, reduces gastrointestinal distress.
So you just wrote a blog on this. I got it in my email inbox.
Yes. Today. Creatine, why it's so important. Yeah.
Yeah. But admittedly, I haven't read it yet. I just read the headline. It's sitting in my email inbox. So it sounds that potentially, is this an across the board thing that you would recommend to female athletes or more so those maybe struggling with the GI issues? Or is it just?
Oh, no.
Or just read your blog.
You can read
and find
it,
out.
But I'll give you the highlights. So creatine across the board, just at a low dose, so the 3 to 5 grams daily, not the high loading doses, really important for women from all the fast energetics. So we look at brain health, we look at heart health, gut health, and then of course, muscle performance. It takes about a month to fully saturate at 3 grams a day, but it's such a small amount that it doesn't cause the side effects that are associated with creatine. And then when we look at the research that specifically kind of looks creatine in the brain, we see that people who suffer from mood disorders have a better incidence of getting out of depression and anxiety when they have more creatine because the brain uses more creatine, uses creatine for the fast energetics. And we see like from a muscle standpoint, you get better recovery, better power from all those athletic endeavors. And then from a GI perspective, it's massively effective for especially my ultra runners or my ultra athletes who have such GI distress. So if you're looking at people who are half marathon to marathon, it works, but even longer than that, because there's so much more that the body is stressed under when you get into that 4 or 5 plus hour range, that the creatine really helps preserve gut function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting. And, you know, also with the current trend, I'll just say dietary trend, of a focus on plant-based diets and things like that, which can have many positive outcomes, but that's another, we're not getting creatine in a more plant-focused diet, whether that means you're vegetarian or vegan or just kind of
plant-focused,
you know, plant-focused. Yeah, whatever, because I need to clarify, plant-focused doesn't mean vegan per se. It just means plant-focused, but creatine we're getting just really from our animal sources. Right. And so if we're buying into or curious about that dietary trend, then that might be further reason to consider
absolutely
supplementation as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So prior to, and some of my listeners know this, some may not, but prior to focusing on female athletes, I worked a number of years with our military and a male-dominated population. And interesting to see women in combat, and as you were mentioning, differences in male and females, even just like the bone structure differences. And it's not necessarily a difference just in total size. You know, there are women who are tall and have broad shoulders, and there are men who are short and have narrow shoulders. And yet there's still some sort of structural difference, because I would witness these military events where, sure, this woman can lift 200 pounds, but the, you know, shape that she had to lift it, you know, onto her shoulders, it just didn't always like work right. And the women were more prone to bone injuries.
Yeah.
Stress fractures. And it just took such a different toll on their body. It wasn't necessarily a matter of strength. Maybe they could lift the weight or do the thing, but it took a different toll. And I think, you know, what you were mentioning about just like bone structures being different, regardless of size, is interesting.
Yep. And center of gravity is different. Women's center of gravity is lower. So when they have to do like the worm or pick something up and put it over their shoulders and carry it that way, men can be more upright because that works with their higher center of gravity. But women have to really hunch over because their center of gravity is lower. So they're trying to get that mass as close to the center of gravity so that they can actually move it forward. I've seen, and I'm sure you noticed this too, the end of basic training, how many injuries and illnesses there were in the women compared to men, primarily because of the loads and the mm-hmm. lack of recovery and, of course, low energy availability. It happens a little bit in men, but the thresholds are different. So you'll see a lot of bone stress reactions in women versus men because that threshold for calorie intake is different. Yeah. So it goes so far. I like every little from whole body all the way down to the molecular, we see that there are these sex differences.
Absolutely. And I think to, again, a lot of this, like you said, it actually starts in utero. And so I don't know if we can expand on this any further, but a lot of it is hormonal based. And so I think we see a huge difference after puberty for male and female. That's where there's like a big difference. Thinking about the youth athlete, are there any other concerns that you might highlight to a parent of a youth female athlete regarding just differences in whether it be sport or nutrition that might be present for a youth, the prepubescent youth athlete?
So prepubescent, most of the systems aren't developed yet. So if we look at sweating mechanisms, right, we're looking at the ability to produce lactate, these are not developed yet. So when we're looking at hydration, super important to remind your kids to drink, because they don't have a developed thirst sensation yet, and they get hotter and hold on to more heat. And because little girls tend to have a little bit more body fat than little boys, then they also have a higher heat load. When we see early stages of, I guess, puberty, which is actually before all the real expression, this is where we start to see girls wanting to sit down more and not participate in sport, because their body is changing in a way where they don't feel comfortable. So we just have to kind of broach that conversation and be like, okay, well, we still want to keep moving, but we want to do more functional movement. And from a nutrition standpoint, it's like really emphasizing protein and making sure there's good carbohydrate availability, because the body is changing and we want to support those changes before we actually get that huge expression that happens when we have estrogen, progesterone that come on board.
And I think it's interesting that in some ways, I think our society can really, our Western society, Western culture can really like over-focus on protein sometimes and under-focus on carbohydrate. And yet still female athletes and those youth female athletes, as you were saying, still might need more protein.
Yeah.
And because then once we do hit puberty and we do have those hormones and we have, you know, where we don't have great testosterone to help with muscle development, and we have things like progesterone, which might make things just, you know, it's important, but a little difficult to recover that muscle. So that I think our society overemphasizes protein. At the same time, we do want to make sure that our youth athletes and female athletes are getting enough, because many aren't.
No, they're not. And it's not just about the sport part, but it's also the development, because, you know, the kids are growing and so their metabolic needs are different. And if you're thinking about all the tissue that's being built from bone to muscle to expanding the heart, the brain, all that kind of, it requires amino acids. So when we look at protein intake, and most kids don't eat a lot of protein because they're like, ooh, crackers. I want crackers. I want crackers. It's really trying to push what kind of proteins can we get into our kids?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you now know, I have a little baby and another one on the way, and it is easy to just feed them crackers all day.
I know.
Hey, it really is.
You saw my daughter, you know, she's 10 and you ask her what she wants for a snack. She's like, crackers. It's like, what?
Yeah.
We need to expand it.
I know. I'm trying so hard. I did blended some Greek yogurt, spinach, strawberry smoothies this morning for him. So that was good, because yesterday I gave way too many crackers for car snacks.
That's okay. Temporary, right? It's days,
yes.
Comes in waves.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I wanted to also talk about something a little more specific. So one of the things you mentioned and we've talked about already today is just females being more at risk of low energy availability, and then that suppressing our hormones, which then has negative health outcomes, including things like more stress injuries. And I wanted to have you give a really great discussion about kisspeptin, what it is and its role in low energy availability, because again, this is something that I never learned in school. I learned this from you.
Oh, nice.
And so, yes. So could you just share with our audience what the heck is kisspeptin?
Yeah. So kisspeptin is a relatively new, I say relatively, in the fact that I think it's really started to be discovered about 12 years ago. And kisspeptin is a neuron area in the KIS gene and the neurons in the hypothalamus. So if we look at the hypothalamus, there are two areas in women's brain that have these kisspeptin neurons. And there's one area in the men's brain. And the areas that are similar in men and women are representative of appetite. So leptin, ghrelin, nutrient density, those kinds of things. And then the second area for women is responsible for endocrine control. So luteinizing hormone pulse, estrogen, progesterone, ovulation, all of those things. So when we start looking at low energy availability, and we have the area in the brain or in the hypothalamus, the kisspeptin neurons that are perturbed by not enough energy coming in particular carbohydrate availability, it downregulates kisspeptin. So it kind of turns these neurons off. And so when they are turned off, then there's the feedback mechanism to the second area to say, hey, you know what? We don't have enough energy coming in. Our appetite hormones are perturbed. So there's something going on there. So there's actually not a lot of energy here to create a baby. So I'm going to stop with my luteinizing hormone pulse. I'm also going to kind of downturn my thyroid because I really need to conserve. I'm in a starvation mode. And so when we start seeing effects of low energy availability, after 4 days of low energy availability, we start to see this perturbance in kisspeptin. We start to see a disturbance in appetite hormones. We start to see a disturbance in thyroid function. And the longer it goes on, the more the signal gets to perturb that luteinizing hormone pulse. If we don't have a daily pulse of luteinizing hormone, we don't get a luteinizing hormone surge. If we don't get that surge, we don't have ovulation. You don't have ovulation, then you don't have estrogen, progesterone, and a menstrual cycle. But because the threshold for low energy availability is different between men and women, we won't really see any kind of endocrine perturbance in men until they're in that area of around 15 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass for about a month or two. But for women, it's that 30 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass. And that happens after 4 days.
Wow. Okay. So just to clarify, because of course, many people understand the role of the hypothalamus in the production of these reproductive hormones. But one of the reasons that the hypothalamus and therefore all down-regulating hormones are more susceptible to low energy availability in women is because kisspeptin has, like you said, those two sections that are affecting it and being greatly negatively affected by low carb availability, low energy availability. Whereas for men, they only have
one
section, yeah. One. Mm-hmm. And that what I just learned from you is that the deficit for men has to be almost twice as severe, mm-hmm. we could say, and not way more than twice as long.
Right. Right. Which is why when you see all the stuff about fasted training, intermittent fasting, you know, all that kind of stuff, and it's male data, you don't see these negative effects because the threshold for perturbance is so different between men and women. And this perturbance is when we start to see that severe endocrine dysfunction. We know that the threshold for women subclinically is around that 35 calorie, right? Yeah. So we start to see some thyroid dysfunction being on the low end of normal of all our hormones, even if we think we're eating enough. But for men, it's still that 15 because of the difference in the kisspeptin responses.
Yeah. And even going back to just whether it's fasting or just the traditional concept of dieting, you know, this is why maybe men can go on a, you know, calorie restricted or any type of diet and see, quote, results, mm-hmm. whereas the women just see a backfiring of new issues.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
And not seeing the same results at all. And I know that's something that women are always frustrated by.
Right. I mean, we can even bring it back to like the hunter-gatherer days, right? And so when you see that there is low food availability, it was the men of the tribe that would go out and they would get leaner and fitter and faster to fight the beast to bring the calories back. But the women of the tribe, they would stop menstruating and they would put on belly fat because they have low calories and they're trying to conserve because if something happens, then they need to have some kind of energy reserve for when the calories come and the menstrual cycle starts again so that they have enough to carry a baby for survival of the species. So from that like old, really old biological, early human primitive days, you see this difference. And so when you bring it forward into modern times, you're like, oh, okay, so this is, you know, aside from all the molecular things that happen, but when I have a couple come in and they're talking to me and she's like, he's following XYZ diet and he's getting fitter and faster and leaner and I'm getting more tired, my sleep's disrupted and I'm putting on a lot of belly fat. What's going on? It's like, because you can't do what he's doing. Your body is not responding because you need more food. You need more calories.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, and this is where one of your slogans, you know, women are not small men, has become so famous and is such a wonderful little slogan. And this might be a nice time to shift and ask you a socially controversial question that you mentioned you were open to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, I'm on board with you. Women are not small men. We are different. And how amazing is it that we can accomplish similar things, maybe in a different way? We also live in a time where people are arguing that or defending that maybe a man's physiology can be transitioned to a female's physiology or a female at birth can be transitioned to a men's physiology. And we see lots of implications in health and also in sport.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, if we're fighting to respect that female physiology is different than a man's, then how can we simultaneously say that a person who is born one way at birth could now become something else?
I know. And this is, it is controversial and I don't ever really talk about it. But when you ask the question, it's like, you know what? It is something that needs to be discussed because I sit on this working group that has sociologists and physiologists and fertility specialists. And then there's me. And it's more than just hormones, and it's more than just sex differences, right? So everyone talks about testosterone levels, and it's not about testosterone. It's about when people go through puberty, because we see this expression and these changes so much, but it's also the psychological and sociocultural aspect. So one of my friends sits on the USA Rowing Board, and they had this big poll of the younger teenage girls and asked them, did they care if there's transgendered girls in the boat? And the girls don't. They don't care. They're like, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're all rowing. We're all friends. It doesn't matter. But when you get to the higher echelons, the story changes because then you're seeing the top of the top. And when you look at the Olympics, you're seeing the best physique and the best characteristics to make someone a winner. So when you start having competition to get to that point, this is where that conversation needs to be more than just hormone or more than just how do you identify. But I don't think people are having that conversation. Because when we look at, okay, what happens at puberty, puberty expression, what are those things that are making transgendered women just have a little bit more of an edge? What if we were to compare athletes who have PCOS to transgendered athletes? Would there still be a difference or not? Because that's the testosterone conversation.
Oh my goodness. Right? Yeah.
But yes. Those conversations aren't being had. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done yet. And so I like the solution that some of the British national sporting organizations have where they have an open category.
Yeah.
And they have a women's category and they have a separate men's category. Sometimes the open and the men's are combined. So when you're looking at age group or elite non-Olympic sports, to me, that seems fair. Because if you're identifying as a man or identifying as a woman, but that's different from how your genetics of XX versus XY, then race mm-hmm. open. That makes sense because there's a huge combination. I mean, in most sports outside of the Olympics, you have just everybody's racing together and it makes it even because then you can compete against who else is in that group and it doesn't matter if it's man or woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the open category is a great option for right now because, as you said, like there's more. It's more than just hormones. It's Absolutely. More than just you know what makes a woman, what makes a girl. It's not just testosterone and estrogen levels, as we already dove into this podcast about. And I think the idea in sports of an open division is wonderful because there's clearly nobody's in full agreement on this topic, right? Yeah. That's why it's controversial. We have opinions and differing opinions. And so it's kind of something that's like, all right, so the people who want things to be separated, we can keep it separated. And if you don't care and want to compete combined, then you can compete combined as well. It is interesting, that study you mentioned about the high schoolers not caring so much. And I think if I were to dive into the psychology research behind that, I think that from a personality trait standpoint and psychological standpoint, women and girls are a lot more agreeable and want to create the happy space and want to, you know, relationships and friendships are far more important from a psychological aspect. So I can see why at a young age, you know, girls and women are just kind of open because they're in that agreeable personality trait. I would say it's a personality trait to tend to be a little more agreeable, open, and where friendships are really, really important. But absolutely when, you know, at those, we say higher echelons, but also I think there's some very, very competitive high school athletes. And, you know, when it's something you really dedicate yourself to, I'll share a little personal story and it's different. But when I was in high school due to Title IX, I was on the women's gymnastics team. And if there's no there was no men's gymnastics team. Men's gymnastics is a different sport. Mm-hmm. There's different events. And so there was a male who competed on my team with me. And he was a great teammate and a good friend. And honestly, it was pretty amazing to see him on the balance beam. Because when do you see a man on the balance beam?
Exactly.
Right? You don't. But I will share, I was the champion sophomore year and junior year, he won and he took that away from me and it crushed me. It really did. But I came back senior year with a vengeance and took my title back.
Nice work. So. Yeah. And I think it's also about the inclusion of sport because that's where the sociocultural part comes in because sport has always been about, well, modern sport, not Olympic sport, but modern sport has been about the participation and the inclusion of everyone's doing one thing. It's when you get to the competitive and the Olympic side where you look at this history of sport. And it's always, always, always been about the demonstration of power and aggression of the male athlete. So those contexts come into play too in this conversation, which people aren't acknowledging unless you're a sociologist.
Right, right. And I think, again, when we think about how far women's sports have come for us to create our space, you know, where men have dominated sports and now we've created our space and still are, I certainly don't want this transgender athletes.
We're still fighting for space, right?
We're still fighting for it. And that's where, and maybe I am letting my personal opinions get in the way right now, but it's just, it's something we're still fighting for our space as female athletes. And so to then have somebody with such a biological difference step in once again, it feels...
Backlash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many more conversations. And here's the thing too. I want to go back to what you and I said in the beginning. Only 4-6% of sports science research is on women, and it's not even good quality research yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do we have like 0.0001% of research on transgender?
We don't really have any.
Because we don't have any.
Yeah, so this is the thing. And I had a really long conversation with my good friend and mentor, Marcia Stefanik. So she was my mentor at Stanford. She's still a full professor. She's been in the women's health space. You know, she's in her 70s now. So she's been in it for a long time. She was the PI of the Women's Health Initiative. So she also is very much mainstream and understands what's going on because she teaches classes in sex identification, transgender, all this kind of stuff. And she's like, we have everyone who's yelling out for research on transgendered, but we don't even have enough research done on women. So when we're looking outside of the medical space, like we have really sound research coming out on surgeries, reassignment surgeries, hormone, all that kind of stuff in the medical field. But outside of the medical field, there isn't any research because the population is so small. And we're still trying to push to get sound research done on the biological female, right? For sex differences and stuff. So we don't even have enough to shout out evidence for that. So then when we start having the transgender conversation in sport, there isn't any research. We have sociocultural research and we have that kind of gendered research from a non-biological standpoint, but we don't have any on transgender athletes in sport because the population is small and people aren't even looking at that as a means of doing sports science research.
Right. Yeah. It's very complicated. And I thank you for being willing to have this conversation. I haven't had it yet. And I thought just looking at it from the scientific perspective with you would be helpful. So thanks for for diving down into it.
No problem.
And the one last comment I'll make on it is, you know, for female athletes, well, a couple, I don't know how many more comments. Okay, let me just start. For female athletes born female, identifying as female, you know, we know how important hormones are and how difficult that phase of puberty is and how important it is for their health as a human being and their success as an athlete. And so when we talk about the importance of fueling enough to get your menstrual cycle and how powerful your menstrual cycle is and creating strong bones, it's like, this is just such an important phase of life. And I think for anybody who might identify, no matter what gender you identify with, to really consider just, I would like the health effects of an importance of hormones.
Yeah.
I think especially during that phase of puberty, that's where it's just so, you know, I think maybe as adults, there's some stability in hormones, but that phase of puberty is just, it's very difficult on 1,000 different levels.
Yeah. And I think one of the, because my daughter is 10, I'm in these conversations with her and they're all afraid because there's such a taboo-ness still around the period and menstrual cycle.
Yeah.
And they don't know what's going to happen. It's been taken out of
scary.
It's been taken out of school education. They don't know what a period looks like because a lot of them think it's going to be like this big, huge gush of blood and they're going to be like lying on the floor looking like they're dying. And we don't explain. My daughter's well educated now, of course, and her friends ask questions.
Yeah, she's your daughter.
Right? But in general, they don't have, like most kids don't have that. And so there's still that huge lack of education. And then when they're in sport, the coaches aren't looking at training the girls different from the boys, right? Because they're like, oh, it's just youth soccer. Let's all go play soccer. Mm-hmm. But we see a higher incidence of dropout and injury in the girls because no one's taking into account these biomechanical changes that are happening. And yeah. There was a documentary where one of the top female coaches, I think it was for UNC, her daughter's a runner. And she's like, I wouldn't push my daughter until she was in her late teens. And even then, it wasn't really pushing, because you don't develop an athlete that's going to be successful when they're 13, 14. You develop an athlete when they're going to be successful when they're in their 20s. And I think that gets not talked about either. So it's like, we don't train our kids like we train our teens. We don't train our teens like we train adults. We have to really look at what's happening in the moment and get that education both to the coaches, but also the kids, so that they're not afraid of what is happening to their body. So that taboo-ness around hormones is still there. And it's kind of frustrating, sad.
Yeah. And so that's why for our girls, I think, you know, learning from people like you and me that, you know, this change is good, it's powerful, and embracing it is so important. It's what will make you. I definitely never resonated with wanting to become a woman, right? So I didn't want to hear that.
No.
But if you say, no, this will make you strong, this will make you keep up with the boys, this will make you be better than the boys, right, or whatever, you know, those are the things that motivated me.
Yeah, exactly.
When I was that age, yeah, of being stronger. And I know, like me personally, I was just always on the shorter side too. So it was like, okay, how can I grow taller and have these strong bones? And that's where it's like, okay, you need your hormones to do that.
Yeah.
Get through puberty, embrace this, and then you can be pushed at the next level. If you can't be pushed when you're 12, but you can be pushed when you're 18,
yeah,
you know, so get there, let your body get there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So women are not small men. We have different female physiology. And because of that, I actually asked my clients if they had any specific questions for you.
Cool.
And some of the things that you speak of often. And so I have maybe some rapid fire questions. You speak a lot about the importance of girls and women doing LHS, which is lifting heavy shit. So again, something where maybe girls and women historically shied away from heavy weights, but actually we need it even more. And maybe you can touch on the importance of lifting weights for women. And then our question is, what if you don't have access to heavy weights, you know, the barbells and squat machines? Mm-hmm. What are the best ways to stimulate bone and muscle stress when you don't have heavy weights available?
Yeah. So resistance training across the board is really important for women, because we see building our bones, we see the lean mass, and we lose lean mass so easily as we start getting older. As we get older, that lifting heavy and power-based stuff is super important, because we need to stimulate central nervous system. Because when we start having a perturbance in our estrogen, we start losing a really powerful hormone for building lean mass. So if we're looking at upskilling and building muscle tissue, we want to do some power-based training, which is that lifting heavy stuff from a central nervous system point of view, to also stimulate muscle recruitment and fibers, because if you're recruiting more fibers, then you're not going to lose them and you're going to have more power and strength. When we look at it from, I don't have heavy weights, how am I going to lift heavy weights? How am I going to do compound movements? There are simple things that we can do with regards to like loading a backpack. We can have kettlebells in the backpack. We can have like household items in the backpack that makes it heavier than body weight. And the goal of it is to work to failure. So if that failure is 10 reps, then that's good. But we want to make sure that we have really good form, because it's form and failure that are the key components for that central nervous system drive. So we want to make sure that we have really good movement mechanics. This is why I have people like really work on movement mechanics for about the first 2 weeks before they add load. We often warm up with plyometric moves. So we get that stimulus of the central nervous system and the rebound and that fast action from a neural standpoint, then we add load. So if we don't have access to heavy weights, we do a progression within a session. We do some mobility, we warm up with some box jumps or some plyo work, and then we get into loading a backpack or doing a lot of single leg stuff with a lighter weight until failure. So we're getting that central nervous system response.
Okay. I love that. That's easy to remember, form and failure. So use whatever weights, household items you can, but form and to failure.
Yeah.
Another more exercise related question. What type of training qualifies as high intensity? And I think one of the background on this question too, specifically when women are struggling with low energy availability, maybe trying to restore or balance hormones, they've been instructed to reduce high intensity exercise. And so kind of what quantifies as that?
Yeah. I'll step it back for recovery from low energy availability. We want to drop volume, but we want to maintain some of the stimulus that we have for our muscles. So I usually have people look at resistance training. And in that high intensity aspect of a resistance training, we're looking at 20-second kettlebell swings or something to that effect, where you're getting an impetus of high intensity, but you're not being fuel depleting. When we look at true high intensity work, we're not looking at 45-minute boot camp. We're not looking at, you know, Orange Theory or F45, because that's moderate intensity. That's very fuel depleting. It drives cortisol up, but it isn't actually true high intensity. When we talk about that true high intensity, it is 85 to 90% of your max for a minute to 4 minutes. And the longer that interval is, the little bit lower intensity it is. But ideally, if you're trying to recover from low energy availability, you're doing some sprint interval work. So you're doing that supra maximal. So it's at 100 to 110% of your max. So it's as hard as you can go for 20 to 30 seconds only, with about 4 to 5 minutes recovery in between. And this is what we mean by true high intensity. So that's why I was saying, you know, a couple of kettlebell swings, 20 seconds of kettlebell swings, and then you're doing some really low intensity mobilization or something between those. So it's not meant to be fuel depleting. It's supposed to be more energizing because it's that central nervous system. It's some metabolic control, but it's not depleting. Mm-hmm.
So I think that the biggest thing here is where people go wrong is where they're doing the what maybe it is more moderate intensity, but they're in the moderate to high intensity, but for long duration.
Yes.
Is where people are really going wrong and putting that low energy availability or their recovery from that at risk. So if they do want to get some high intensity in, they could do so in these really short bursts, 20 to 40 seconds, but it seems like that rest time in between is very important.
Super important. Yeah. I did a true sit workout the other day. I was feeling a bit low, not a lot of energy, but it was a 10-minute warm-up on the bike at like 100 watts. And then there were five specific intervals for 30 seconds at 500 watts and then 4.5 minutes of 90 watts. And people are like, what? What is that? So the 500 watts was as hard as I could go for 30 seconds. And then the 90 watts was barely any pressure on the pedal, where I wasn't sweating. I was almost like a recovery sitting down heart rate by the time it was due the next interval. I only did five of them. That's a true sprint interval workout. But it's on the bike, so of course it's going to be a longer recovery. But if you're doing any other kind of mode, then you know you're going to have a little bit of a shorter true duration, because if you're running high intensity for 30 seconds, you're not going to necessarily need 5 minutes between, because you can fully recover through walking within 2, maybe 3 minutes.
Walking. Yes. I hope people heard that.
Yes. You're polarizing.
Walking in between. Yes. Yes. Just a couple other quick questions for you. I think quick. I don't know. Does the impact of caffeine change across the menstrual cycle?
You know, it is, doesn't have any real impetus across the menstrual cycle. It's really what your SIP gene is. So we have people who are responders versus non-responders and over-responders. Mm-hmm. And that really dictates. But we do know, though, is in the high hormone phase, where your body is conserving more carbohydrate and shuttling it away to the endometrial lining, that if you have caffeine in exercise, it clears your blood sugar out a lot faster. So you need to eat when you have caffeine more so than you do in the low hormone phase. So there is just that nuance of blood sugar control, regardless of if you're a responder or non-responder.
And this is really interesting too, just because in that high hormone phase, lots of women experience sleep disturbances, and then maybe they're more tired throughout the day, and then maybe they're relying more on caffeine.
Yes.
And then now this is altering blood sugar response a little
bit. Yes. Because caffeine, you know, it also clears blood sugar quickly to encourage free fatty acid use. So if you're already, your body's already like, hey, I need some blood sugar and I'm a bit more insulin resistant, a little bit, having a little bit more of an issue with blood sugar control. And then you're adding caffeine that's like, hey, let's get rid of that blood sugar and start working on free fatty acids. People will definitely feel the ups and downs more. So it's looking at maintaining blood sugar control. So if you are having caffeine, if you're having coffee, then you do want to put some milk in there that has some protein or protein powder, or you're eating something with it so that you have more of that balance of that blood sugar.
Now, this is interesting too, because as some of those glucose wearable devices are coming out for the healthy and or athletic population, not just for diabetes management, I think this is becoming more known. And I don't know, I've never tried them myself yet, so I won't speak on them too much, but I have had a client who noticed that her blood sugar responses and caffeine seem to have a different effect based on her menstrual cycle. And so this is,
yeah.
And it was because she was wearing one of those wearables. Oh, yeah. And, you know, we were just kind of like going over her results a little bit. So it was interesting. One other question for you again, which I think is very individualized and very nuanced. We know that athletes can have low resting heart rates. However, also when we're in low energy availability, we can have low resting heart rate for not good reasons. Yeah. Is there a too low? Is there some sort of threshold? This is a question from a client. Is there a too low resting heart rate for a female athlete? And is there a difference in this for an elite versus recreationally competitive athlete?
I don't know any research that talks about things being too low. But when we look at low energy availability versus fitness, there's a difference in heart rate variability. So when we're in low energy availability, that heart rate variation decreases. So you're not as stress resilient. So if you're trying to determine if you're kind of really fit with a low resting heart rate, or you are in low energy availability with a low resting heart rate, watch your heart rate variability instead, because this gives you better indication of what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as for is it too low, I haven't seen any research that shows. I'm sure that if you're below 30, there's an issue.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny because the client who asked me this question, one of her things that keeps coming up is she gets the reminder in the middle of the night or when she wakes up of your heart rate went this low. And it's, you know, she's recovered from LEA and doing really well and has her menstrual cycle, but she keeps getting these notifications and it keeps kind of freaking her out that she's going backwards. And so we keep going over her data again and going over her food and her training and I hope she's going to listen to this episode.
Yeah.
You're all good. You're doing good.
So. Yeah. And if she's one of the things we also know for people who are recovering from LEA is they can also get hypoglycemic at night, which can cause some heart rate disturbances and wake ups. So if she.
And that's why they wake up hungry.
Yes, exactly. And
for other listeners going through that.
Yeah. So using. One of the reasons we like to use a continuous glucose monitor is just to look at what's happening at night, because people think that they're doing all right, but their sleep is perturbed and it's because they're waking up hypoglycemic. So that also has an effect on heart rate. So that could be something she wants to think about. Just a little dose of casein before bed can help with that.
Amazing. Okay. Well, those were the rapid fire questions from my clients, and we are just out of time. I know you got to go. You're a busy woman. Thank you so much for this. I do have a few just super quick fun ones that I ask all my guests.
Sure.
Okay. If you could eat one food every single day for the rest of your life and never get sick of it, what would it be?
Oh, does coffee count?
Sure.
Okay. Coffee.
Yeah. I mean, mine's coffee ice cream.
So oh, yeah. Okay.
Yours is just coffee.
Coffee. Yep.
Love it. Amazing. What's your favorite sport to participate in?
Bike racing.
And how about as a spectator? What's your favorite sport to be a fan of and watch from the sidelines?
Soccer.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
All right. And then final question. If there's a female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to for being a role model, inspiration, whether in your personal life or really well known, who would that be and why?
Probably not known very well in the U.S. population, but in the rugby world, Ruby Tuohy.
Okay.
So Ruby Tuohy is a professional rugby player here in New Zealand, but she is the epitome of a role model because she's humble, she's open, she's encouraging, she has the power of persuasion to really include all spectators, regardless of male, female, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And she is just a powerhouse and someone that I think can really show so many female athletes like how to work the media in a positive manner, as well as empower young girls and older men to really encompass female athletes.
Amazing. Yeah. So Ruby Tuohy, yeah. We'll have to get to know her if our U.S. listeners don't yet. Stacey, thank you so much for this awesome conversation. Yeah. We appreciate all that you do for female athletes.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie. Please go check them out and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide, or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.